it's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate, and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Welcome to America, land contaminated by brainwashed masses, land-based and white skin privilege. Cultural genocide, killing ourselves slowly and knowing who we are inside. Ashamed to speak our native tongue, stripping ourselves of our birth-given name. And now the reflection in the mirror no longer looks the same. Slowly we change, confirm, and assimilate. Our culture, history that it once was so beautiful, now replaced with self-hatred.
To ban it in culture, to rest in this thing. Conscious emulation from a culture genocide. It is the boldness and pride of humanity. That is the struggle versus some within a week. The practice and training to target is a loss. Lost it in a way to be a soul.
Okay, today we're speaking with Jay Lee, part of the band Resist and Exist, long-time participant in the anarchist punk scene. We're going to be talking kind of about the history of anarcho-punk in the United States. Your history goes back a long time, and I know your friends and know a lot of people that are in the kind of like originators of the scene in the UK. And we're going to talk about kind of your experiences growing up in the U.S. and just kind of seeing that whole movement and scene flourish in Southern California mostly, and just kind of pick your brain about some stuff.
Yes. When I got into punk rock, I was like into all like British stuff, like GBH, Exploded, Leather Jacket. And I was more into that whole fashion stuff. I believe it was either 83 or late 82 or maybe 83. I met Mark from ADS, Another Destructive System, on Melrose Avenue. This is before he started the band Another Destructive System. Him and his friend Greg, at that time in 1983, they had like Icons of Filth tattoo, Conflict tattoo. I never heard of these bands, and they were playing this music to me, and I tripped out on that. And also during that time in 84, I believe, there was a band called Iconoclast in 1984. Now, I'm still like, you know, into the whole like, you know, fashion punk stuff. And this band in 84, Iconoclast, they had tons of banners against war, against apartheid, just a bunch of stuff. It was really radical punk message. And the weirdest thing was, before they played live, they told everybody to sit down, and the singer was reading a poetry about anarchy or something, and I just tripped out on that, and that introduced me to the whole different punk scene. Like these punks, Iconoclast and their friends, they wouldn't wear leather, they were in all black, they were anarchists, they were vegetarians. At that time, it blew my mind. And in the parking lot, there was all these cars with like radical stickers against apartheid in South Africa, peace stickers, vegetarianism, and all that. And at that same time, Grateful Dead was touring too. So all these punks, when there was no punk shows or when they're touring, we would never go in, but we would hang out in the parking lot. So these were all like the anarchist peace punks and stuff that I got introduced to. But I did not get in the scene in 1984. I got into it in 1985. I would go check out the shows and stuff like that. But I got into it in 1985.
And how young were you then?
Oh, 1985, I was 16. But I met guys from my Kano class. I met them when I was like 15. That was Renee, but he goes by Yao now. He's also in Oz Underground. I was very, very young. But when I met them, I was not into it. I got into it like later on, like 2 years later or a year later and stuff. Got involved with the movement and then became vegetarian and stuff. But at that time, you have to also understand there was like in Orange County in Anaheim, there was I believe it was Tammy from Nature Corps. There was the Anacha Feminist Group. And there were zines coming out from Orange County. There was already a peace punk scene going on. And people thought like I started it. But I didn't start it. It was way before my time. You got to ask the guys from my Kano class. They're the ones who was involved. Like since like 1982. I got into it in 85. I saw things happening in 1983. Like I would check it out. But I was not involved with it. I would awesome. Like check out the shows and stuff.
In a Kano class, that was a band from Southern California, Orange County of California, right?
Yes. But no, they were from L.A., but there was like little things going on all the time at different places. There was a scene in Orange County. There was also a scene in Long Beach. And there, it was a small group of like punk rock anarchist group that would have meetings. There was IWW. They would have meetings in Long Beach. And there was also like a anarcho punk band at that time called A Solution. The early A Solution, they were all like into, I don't know, it was weird. Like in the 80s, if you're an anarchist, if you're punk rock, you were into everything. You were against apartheid in South Africa. You were into animal rights. You were like environmental shit. It was all like one thing. It was like a whole like, and we get traded zines, have pen pals, trade packages from people from England. And
well, cause I think this is really interesting because, like, there's been so many, like, punk rock documentaries, especially, like, focusing on, like, hardcore or, like, Black Flag and, like, especially Southern California. And I feel like the picture that's painted is that basically SoCal was, like, the Circle Jerks and TSOL and Black Flag. And that was kind of the scene. And that there was, like, a few political bands and that was basically just the Dead Kennedys. And maybe DOA in Vancouver, Canada. And that was about it. And like everybody else was just kind of like, you know, like they were singing about like Reagan and politics, but there weren't bands that like had like, you know, an anarchist message or something that kind of took it beyond like Reagan sucks. I hate the cops.
Oh, no, not at all. But you have to understand our scene was very small. We were all spread out and there was a, few bands who were totally connected with it, even in the 80s. There was like bands like Nature Corps, early Apocalypse, early Glisten Max. There was, of course, there was A Solution and, I believe they were called also Terminal Choice, but there was all these small bands and there was all these small collective that was going on. People thought in the 80s, Southern California scene, I mean, our anarcho scene was big. It wasn't. It was small. But it's because everybody was in different bands. Everybody did fanzine. People belonging to different collective. They have meetings, picnics. We met at all these different anti-war nuclear demonstrations because in the 80s, it was a whole different thing. Alliance for Survival organization was going on. And there was anti-vivisection rallies going on. But a lot of things were going on, but we were not huge. We were like a small pocket movement. That's why you would never see us in documentary. If I mentioned bands like, hey, have you heard of Nature Corps? At that time in the 80s, it was a woman fronted band. Her name was Tammy, and she was full on. The whole band was vegan back then. Talked about anarchism, supporting the Big Mountain, Native American and everything. I mean, they did benefits and all that. But if you talk to these kids now, they have no idea what it is. And it's kind of sad because a lot of, even the guy from my Kano class, original guitarist, I mean, not original guitar, Ivan used to put out a full on anarchist fanzine. This is not a punk fanzine. This is full on like activist anarchist fanzine in the 80s. The thing is, we never save those flyers. We never document. We didn't carry cameras around, which break my heart. It's pretty much erased history. Or her story and everything.
And a lot of these bands, did they go on to record like 7 inches at least, or do they have any? Were they on?
Yes. Yes. All the bands have demo tape. Iconoclast had a 7-inch out. Naturecore had a mini LP out. It was put out by No Gods No Master, which was it was a singer from Vegan Right, but the singer from Vegan Right was Sean. Before he got into that, he was also a peace punk in the old days. We used to hang out at the picnic in the 80s. He would be a full-on peace punk, and he would come to the picnic. He would just put out a blanket. He would have all kinds of, I'm not kidding you, all kinds of different literatures, animal rights literatures, and what else? Cassette tape of anti-sec. I never heard of anti-sec stuff like that back then. I mean, all kinds of stuff. Like, we would have all these different picnics. And people will bring all the stuff. And our friends at that time from Long Beach, like, gosh, this is so long time ago, by Mark and other folks like John, Al, they all went to England in the 80s and they brought all these demo tape back, and we would like dub it and hear it, listen to it. And that's how we get to find out about all these other UK bands and stuff. And we started pen pals, trading packages from all different countries. And it was a very interesting time back then. But like I said, we did not take pictures. I mean, there's a couple pictures that's rare, but zines and flyers, never saved it. I saved some of them. I moved around and stuff. And then there's also Tammy from Media Children. This is different Tammy, who was a full-on radical anarchist, supporting ACT UP. This was in like 88 too. Not mid-80s, later on, like 88, ACT UP was going on. She was my inspiration. She would take me to rallies and stuff. ACT UP was really crazy back then too. And there was queer, she supported Queer Nation. I don't know, there were so many things going on. Like, you know, my memory comes and go and stuff. So,
for sure.
Yeah, you weren't, I mean, now, the reason I'm saying back then, if you're an anarchist, you weren't into everything, was because now you have so many different types of anarchists. Then when we went up to San Francisco, we met I tripped out in San Francisco. The anarchists were like just normal looking people, like, you know, and they were on us. They were like, we tripped out on them because we thought at that time only the anarcho punks or the peace punks were anarchists. And we met all the like serious older anarchists who were reading books. And Northern California was a whole different scene for us when we visited. But here in Northern California, there was also like really young bands. They didn't last long. It was called Atrocity, A State of Mind, Trial, Treason, and all those bands. But their scene was very, very small too. And a lot of those bands didn't stay that long as well.
You know, just one other thing on kind of like the image of punk in the early to mid 80s. I think the other thing that's really kind of put forward is, I mean, especially if you read things like Get in the Van, Henry Rollins, story about, Life in Black Flag. I mean, it seems like really violent. Like there was, you know, skinheads around, police would break up, concerts. There were just fights a lot of the times in the audience. Was the early anarcho scene within the punk scene, was that like in response to that at all? Or did you notice a lot of violence back then? Or
it depends what shows you go to. If you go to Olympic Auditorium shows in the 80s, like in 84, 85, of course there's going to be violence. You're talking about, you have like thousands of people there. You have punks from all different backgrounds. You have like all kinds of punks. Or Fender's Ballroom, yes. But, I mean, I see this documentaries, like a lot of old punks talking about violence and stuff. Of course, there was gangs there. I mostly hanged out in Los Angeles. But, you know, you could see like gangs like, you know, Los Angeles Death Squad, but West Side was really cool. Then there was all other punk gangs like SR, FFF, and all those gangs. But I think due to I was so young, I was like 16 or 15. None of the gangs really bothered me. And I mostly minded my own business. Of course, there was fights all the time at big concerts. Now, all the punk shows wasn't like that. Depends what kind of shows you go to. At Olympic, when I saw Subhumans, of course, there was fights every 15 minutes, every 10 minutes, 10 against 2. Actually, one of my friends got stabbed at Olympic too, Olympic Auditorium. He used to be in a gang. He was in the West Side Lads, but later on, later, yeah, he was in the gang. But at that time, like, But he got stabbed, but he actually sang for, not sang, he played drum for Enema Mundi. He became like really cool, like, you know, peace punk and stuff. He's like 4 or 5 years older than me and stuff like that. But yeah, it depends. I minded my own business. Even my high school, lads went to my high school and stuff, even in the late 80s. As for skinheads, there was all different types of skinheads. You had regular oi skinheads who didn't want to get into politics, and you have the anti-racist skinheads, and you have the punk rock skinheads, and you have the Nazi skinhead. When I was going to La Vista High School in Fullerton, my friend James, he was a really cool skinhead. Yeah, there was bad things going on. Like, you know, they came when I was at his house. About 7 of them came with baseball bats. His brother had to pull out a gun, and they threw a brick through the window. And my old friend Sheepdog, who did a white fanzine, there was a spray paint war going on. What happened was on the freeway, he would put, like, you know, there was all these flux of pink Indians, peace sign, then war, which was called White Aryan Resistance, which was a faction of, I believe, from Tom Metzger group. They would come and spray paint over stuff. They would put war on it. And they would come, they found out where he lived, and they would come to his house with baseball bats. And then, we're still talking about the skinhead. And then there was all kinds of skinhead gangs. Even P9 Death Squad was around and stuff like that. But we ran into them and stuff like that. We pretty much minded our own business. But when we have shows, none of the gangs, skinheads rarely come to our show, because it was like DIY show. At the flyers, we'll put like organization, what table, speakers, piece. When they see that, they go, "Oh, we don't want to come to this." So that's a lot of our shows. Like, you know, we're more small, but it was more educational, radical. We have pamphlets and stuff like that. But normally, gangs didn't show up. Once in a while, only small things happen at ADS show, like fights break out. A skinhead gang, they got chased off and stuff. But yeah, there was all kinds of skinheads back then too. We even had cool skinhead friends.
Was there a lot of factionalism in the punk scene? Because I mean, like, did just like the political anarcho-punks go to those shows, or was like everybody going to all the different kinds of shows, kind of like under the umbrella of punk? I mean, obviously there's a lot of different genres, and by 1984-85, you know, it had split in different ways.
Well, there was a split, because due to, at that time, Golden Voice was putting out a lot of shows. I went to a lot of Golden Voice shows. That's why, Mark from Another Destructive System started the AGC. Originally, AGC stands for Anti-Golden Voice Campaign.
What's Golden Voice again?
Mark started an AGC in the 80s called Anti-Golden Voice Campaign. Originally, that's what AGC stood for. So it was to put out benefit shows, doing our own DIY shows without rip off Golden Voice at that time.
No, I was just asking, the Golden Boys, was that a band, or that was?
Oh, no. Golden Boys was a big, it was run by a person named Gary back then. They would bring bands like GBH, Exploder, Conflict, and all these bands. But this was later on. People started boycotting Golden Voice because punks wanted to do their own DIY shows.
Gotcha. So,
a lot of that peace punks and anarcho punk stopped going to Golden Voice shows, but I went to all kinds of shows. I still went to Golden Voice shows and stuff.
You know, I just kind of want to pause now and ask. So when people think of peace punk or anarcho punk, one of the first names they think about is Crass, which is a band that came out of England. I believe their first record was 1978, right? So it was like right after kind of the initial punk explosion, you know, they released Feeding of the 5,000. Which still today is, you know, great album. You know, they really had just like a different sound than a lot of other punk bands. They had just, and they incorporate all these different elements. They put a lot of like samples, and I mean, they could do a whole podcast on that band itself, but I mean, they're kind of like DIY, record label grew, and they kind of like influenced like a whole bunch of bands that came behind them, and bands that had lots of different sounds, from like the Poison Girls to Sounds to Conflict. What was the connection between that scene and what was happening in the U.S.?
Well, U.S., a lot of the us were inspired by that kind of music. So there was bands like that. We were like try to, the only thing we couldn't do like the England was squatting. We couldn't squat. I mean, I used to be a runaway too when I was 16 years old. Our squat just lasted for a month and a half because at that time, Hollywood, there was a lot of runaway kids. So before the Olympic was going on in 1984, LAPD did some kind of curfew, and anyone who didn't have an ID, they would take them in and stuff like that. So we couldn't do squats because, I mean, even if it did, it squats didn't last long. But the only thing we could, like, try to do what they did was just zines, bands, and collectives, and like picnic, like Freedom Day in the city of Orange, which was done by Pat Mitchell from Gutter Press Fanzine. And that would bring like about 60 to 70 punks. And we would like, they would have like vegan food, literature. People would bring their own zine. A lot of people did zine back then because there was no internet. So it was like a Xerox copy zine, all like, you know, was band interview letters, like, you know, just the opinion, political opinion. There was a lot of protests going on at that time in the 80s because everybody was fearing nuclear war. A lot of peace protests going on. So we would hang out there. And also a lot of animal rights protests was going on too. So there was like animal freedom fighter group. There was suppressed anti-vivis. Wanda from Society Against Vivisection will put out stuff. Man, there were so many things going on. I'm just actually getting a flashback talking to you right now. But like I said, a lot of people think that 80 was really big. But I have to disagree with that. I think now the punk rock scene is really huge.
Did Crass or any of those bands ever come to the U.S. or did people?
Oh, yes.
Did people ever go there? And I'm curious, like, when did that kind of connection begin? And and also, like, where? So, like, in the mid '80s, were bands from here that were like in the anarcho-punk umbrella, were they like sending stuff over there? Like, was there any sort of international dialogue?
Yeah. Eve Libertine came here in 19, that was in the 90, I'm sorry. She came in 1990, but not the band Crass, played in California. No, they didn't, never came to California. But, the thing is, even in England, there was, okay, I'm going to name some bands you never heard of. Oh, I don't know if you heard of them. They were from Motorhead record, like Excess Dance, the Liberty Potential Threat. My friends and everybody were like, you know, writing to Sean from Existence and, you know, United Anarchist Front. And we were writing back and forth to Colin from Conflict. And there was bands like Icons of Phil. There was all these offshoot Crass bands. Like the bands who used to, before they were in a band, people used to follow Crass around in England. And all those kids, they started bands that was like, you know, Conflict, Crass. I mean, I'm sorry, Conflict, Icons of Phil. All these people who used to follow Crass around. There were so many anarcho bands in England too. So like, I can't even name it all, but we were writing to them. Yes. But Crass, no, I didn't have direct contact with Crass. No, I didn't.
Did any of those UK bands come over here, or did anybody from?
Yeah, definitely. Conflict came in here in 1985. Conflict did. But we were all tripping out on Conflict because the thing, my friends and I, we picture Conflict as like, you know, but when Conflict came here, they said they weren't pacifists and they were ready to brawl. They said they would fight skinheads. And actually at the show at Fenders, they were telling all my friends, you know, I mean, I was 16 back then, but my friends were like in their 20 or 19. They wanted to get all together, end of the show and fight back. And
we against Nazi skinheads?
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, because that...
They were causing problem at the show. And they were saying straight out, you know, we're not pacifists. We're not peace punks. We're anarchists.
Right. Well, just for people that are listening that aren't kind of like hip to some of this... this history, Crass, when they came out, they said basically, you know, we're anarchists, but we're also pacifists, and we're, you know, they kind of had this thing, like, we oppose all violence, whether it's, like, left-wing or right-wing, kind of like, I mean, today it would be seen as kind of like a backwards kind of position, but as the band kind of evolved and grew, and also as, you know, a lot of things in British history took place, when they were a band, because I mean, Thatcher came into power, there were massive riots in the urban cities in like 81 and 85. There were big strikes that a lot of anarchists were taking place in. There was also groups like Class War that kind of came onto the scene that
very involved with Class War.
Yeah, very strongly kind of aligned within like the anarcho-punk scene. And, I mean, things like the miner strike happened, so people saw like a lot of working class people fighting back. And then also there was all the fascist stuff, and people kind of like had to figure out what they were going to do with that. Like, were they going to sit there and get beat up, or, you know, were they going to defend themselves? And I think by the time that Crass ended in like 84, 85, actually their last show was a benefit for the miner strike. They had I wouldn't say they were running around promoting violence, but I mean, they were saying basically, yeah, we're going to defend ourselves. We're not pacifists anymore, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. But Conflict was like really like direct action at that time.
Sure.
And like even the U.S. fans in called Flipside, they interviewed them too. Like the mainstream punk magazine, they were really well known at that time. And even Flipside, on the interview on the Flipside fanzine, Conflict said that, yeah, we don't take shit. They said that one of the skinhead came to the show to cause problems. They smashed a brick through his face and stuff, and he started crying. That's how fucking Conflict was, like full on direct action. We would like read about them.
How did they go over in the United States? Because I remember if you listen to Henry Rollins' thing from Get in the Van about him going to the UK, it's like basically they just kind of got the cold shoulder from the British bands. But I mean, when Conflict came over to the US, were people like, a lot of people, just not even the anarcho-punks, but a lot of people came out to see them, and did they have a big impact when they toured?
Yes, all kinds of people went to see them, all kinds of punks. You have to understand, Henry Rollins, when he played in England, I believe he played with the Exploited, so of course he's going to get that kind of crowd. If Henry Rollins played with, like, either Conflict or Crass in the early 80s, he would have got a more, like, you know, cool crowd. Like a different crowd and stuff. So it really depends what kind of bands or followings you play with in England as well. Same goes for America too.
Gotcha. Yeah. So we're in the mid 80s now. Conflict has come. So there's starting to be kind of, an interchange between like these various scenes. How did things evolve after kind of the mid 80s? Well, where did they go?
I stayed the same, but a lot of my friends, after talking to Conflict and stuff, they became all like, radical fighting back.
Yeah.
And drop all the pacifist stuff. Drop all the pacifist views, full on direct action and stuff like that. So a lot of my friends changed that way too.
Were they still mostly involved in just music stuff, or did they start to get involved in like groups or political campaigns? Or?
Yes. Actually, some of my friends, they got sick of the whole punk scene and got more serious, and they kind of stopped going to show and became more political and stuff like that. That's why the organization and collective, or they will leave the punk scene and get into I'm not saying everyone. Of course, a lot of people had to drop out because some of them just got only focused on animal rights stuff. Some of them actually got job for Alliance for Survival, or gosh, I forgot there was another anti-nuke thing. But yeah, people went all different directions, and yeah, some people just actually left the punk scene, got more serious.
Yeah,
I mean, not everyone. I'm saying the people I know.
When, you know, in terms of music, I think when people think like into like the late 80s, everybody talks about like crossover, and crossover in the sense of like punk and metal started to kind of fuse, and that, you know, things became a lot more like metal influence or hard rock. I mean, obviously in Seattle we had the grunge scene kind of develop, but I mean, there started to be kind of like less hardcore punk stuff and more like, you know, other more metal influenced things. I mean, like stuff like,
right. I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm really glad you mentioned that, because earlier I told you, remember I told you about when my friends went to England? They went to England again, I believe in 88. That's when all the crossover was going on. So there was, in England at that time, there was this thing called Crust or Stenchcore, whatever. There was bands like Hellbasters, Deviant Instinct, Extreme Noise Terror, all these demo tape they would bring. And the thing is, back then, if you say crust in England, all those crust bands were like, not all of them, but a lot of them were like, you know, political. They were vegetarians, and everything. So that was started in Long Beach too. Long Beach crustcore crew. You know, these were crusty punks who are politically active, didn't wear leather. That's what, like, Glisten Max, they got more heavier. Apocalypse got more heavier too, with same message. A Solution got more heavier, and it started changing. All the crossover was going on. They were playing like crust stuff. But now, if you say crust, you would think totally different. I mean, of course, people were like, you know, still having a good time, but the word crust, if you said that in the 80s, you will automatically think, oh, all black, vegan, into political stuff. You know,
right,
that's the,
right.
And drinks a lot.
Right. Now, did you ever go over to the UK yourself?
No. I never went to England.
But you had a pretty close relationship, I know, to the conflict people.
Yeah, because every time oh my gosh, I can't even count how many times I'd seen conflict. I even invited myself to their RV and just went on tour with them. Follow them around all over West Coast. I seen them so many times, but not just conflict. We had a lot of friends, and I came close to going to England, but it's a long, complicated story. But my friends went to the London Anarchist Gathering, because there were so many things going on here. I wish I would have traveled, but for some reason I didn't travel that much at that time.
Yeah. What did you feel like in the 80s, like talking to them, how they felt like things had grown in terms of just anarcho-punk? Cause I mean, it really spread so far. I mean, were they kind of like taken aback by it, or?
Oh, what are you talking about?
I'm saying, like, were they aware of like how much that they had, like, I mean, not just them, of course, but Crass, and just like kind of like the, basically the seeds from like all those bands and those projects and everything, like how far they had basically flown across the world and like started to grow in other places. Like, did that just trip them out, or?
Well, I don't know, because like it was always at that time, Maximum Rock and Roll was a really cool fanzine, because like there were scene reports from every different countries, and like they would cover all kinds of stuff. So we already knew it was all over the world. It went all the way to South Africa and everywhere.
Yeah.
So we already knew that in the 80s because of all the zines and pen pals we had.
Yeah. Well, when did you start to like become involved in like, doing your own bands?
Oh, well, my first band was called Media Children.
Uh-huh.
It's started with Tammy, I believe it was 1988. Yeah, 1988 is the first. We started in 1988. We did a 4-track demo tape. And then that's about it. And then Media Children, of course, continued with Tammy singing. And I think 1990, they got an EP out. That was without me, though. But I continued to stay friends with them for a long time.
When did the first like anarchist center get started in Southern California?
Well,
know, like Info Shop, or
they were gonna, everybody was gonna start it in late 85 or 85, and people and like everybody, Iconoclast was trying to do it, and also people were putting out compilation. All the kids were putting out compilation cassette tape to do an anarchist center here, because at that time, up in Northern California, San Francisco had an anarchist bookstore, which it's still going on today, Bound Together. And there was all kinds of stuff going on in San Francisco. So we wanted to do here, but it never happened until way later. I believe it was 1990. Okay, it was 1992. There was an anarchist gathering going on. Do I talk about the 90s or should I save it?
No. I think we got to that point. We can start talking about the 90s.
So in 1992, I was living in a co-op house, Food Not Bombs co-op house. They started in the late 80s. We're the third chapter of Food Not Bombs at that time. So we got a co-op house with Camille, Christine, and Jeff, and a bunch of other people. We were living collectively in 92. I forgot how old. Maybe I was 25 in 92. I don't know. But anyways, at that time, a lot of the 80s, like I said, some people got sick of punk rock. They wanted to do other things. So I would say 95% of the people who were involved with the 80s movement got out. So I brought it up. Hey, why don't we continue what the folks tried to do in the 80s, open up an anarchist center. So after that Long Beach anarchist gathering, we opened up the anarchist center, which was called D Center. And it was an open collective. We finally did it.
Now, is this the one that Total Chaos helped fund?
Oh, yes. Total Chaos helped us a lot.
I just want to give a shout out to them, because I remember when I was growing up and I first saw them, I was like, what is this kind of like chaos punk looking band? I mean, like very spikes everywhere, really spiky hair. And like,
I know this sounds,
but really, they were down.
I know this sounds really crazy. I'll try to make this short as possible. At that time, even in the 90s with Total Chaos, all the show was fucking crazy. Like, it was total chaos. I know some of the anarcho-punk now, they don't like them, but the singer Rob, he always stood his ground. He never fucking backed down against neo-Nazi skinheads. He even got stabbed. I mean, I wasn't there, but he got stabbed. He had to go to the hospital. He got stabbed because he had a black girlfriend at that time. And they were saying shit. He always stood his ground. He never backed down. And even different areas, people flattened their van and everything. But so sometimes I would get fucking scared to see Total Chaos, because every time even one or two skinheads, like Nazi skin, he sees them on the crowd, he would always say something on the mic. He would go, I would go, oh, fuck. Here he goes again.
So what would happen back then? I mean, but like, let's say you're at a Total Chaos show and there's a bunch of people there and the singer points out, there they are. What happens next?
I mean, if it's LA, it would be cool. LA would be cool because you have more of our friends up there. But he did that in San Diego and I was going, fuck, these guys are so fucking big and muscular. We're going to all fucking get killed. We're going to get killed. I wouldn't know how to fight. We're all skinny back then, you know? I didn't know how to fight back then, like, and he would just say something, but like, sometimes like he would say crazy, I mean, he said he didn't, but I remember to this day, he was just saying, kill the Nazis, like, so no one's gonna believe this, I have a picture of him arguing with skinheads on backstage with neo-Nazi skinheads, arguing, I took a picture of it, I still have that picture to this day, because nobody will believe that stuff.
What were they arguing about?
How he would say how fucked up, how stupid white supremacy is to the skin of space. I was going, wow. But he was, I mean, a lot of people think Total Chaos is a drunk punk band, but he was pretty fucking, I don't care what people say, he always fucking stood his ground. He's been my friend since I was in high school. I knew him since the 80s.
Yeah, I remember, I mean, we'll talk about this.
Always stood his ground, though.
I remember in their CDs, they were always saying, like, be sure to check out the Wall of Injustice.
Oh, yeah. That was my old newsprint fanzine. I used to, the most I printed was 7,000 copies.
Yeah. But, yeah. I mean, I just want to point that out for people that don't know, that maybe have seen that band on, like, maybe a Epitaph Records comp or something like I did when I was a kid. And just like, it was kind of like, eh. You know, but they had a role in anarchist history, and it's a It's important to mention that.
They helped out a lot. They did a lot of benefit shows and stuff. Even 2000 and stuff. They even did a benefit show for Black Bloc and everything.
Yeah.
Even Black Bloc used to make fun of them because they were kind of Black Bloc rally.
Right, right.
Punks, you know, they have all spiked hairs. They were taking pictures. Like a professional guy was taking pictures. They brought a photographer. Black Bloc all got pissed off. They were making fun of them. But then when Black Bloc got arrested, and they did a benefit show for Bloc too.
So when did this center open? You said it was the early 90s?
Oh, yeah. The D Center closed in 1994, after a year and a half.
Now, did it open before or after the L.A. Rebellion?
Oh, it was after the L.A. Rebellion. L.A. Rebellion was 1992. Oh, I'm glad you mentioned L.A.
Well, yeah, I definitely want to talk about that.
We were all there before it started, because what happened was Citizen Fish was playing.
Yeah.
We were all in a car, and then we heard the news, and we heard that all these protests were going on, and all it was at the I have a couple pictures of it from the Parker Center. So then all the punks started coming because there was a protest going on against police brutality, and the punks would say, "Hey, we saw it in the news. We saw our friend," and more punks would show up. Total Chaos showed up and everything. So during the nighttime, when it was getting darker, at that time, everybody was protesting police brutality after the verdict. In downtown, there was all kinds of people, even college student, community organizer. But as it got darker, I noticed a lot of the white people were gone. And then I turned around and started seeing all these fires and stuff. Like, people were even setting tree on fire because people were angry. And some people came to protest. Of course, some kids, they come for fun just to mess things up or burn trees and stuff. And I actually took a picture of this and put it on my Facebook. It was one of my friends. He passed away way later on. He has a Mebex jacket on. He had a huge stick on burning stuff. But I just went there to protest and just to take pictures and stuff. And at that time, I had a camera. So we didn't go to the Citizen Fish show. Found out Citizen it was in the news. At the news, and then, you know, a couple of people saw punks earlier, so all the punks came out and stuff too.
Well, I wanted to ask, because you're Korean.
Yes.
And a huge part of the there was kind of this underlying tension within the African American community with Korean shop owners. You know, Ice Cube famously released a song called Black Korea, which was kind of like aimed at Korean shop owners. This was after, I think, a young African-American kid was shot and killed by a store owner for shoplifting or something like that. And during the riots, there was kind of like targeted looting and arson attacks against some Korean businesses. Also, a lot of Korean people got together and like made banners and protested and made it clear that they were in solidarity with the protests against police brutality and the rebellion. But I'm just curious, you know, what was that dynamic like?
There was a huge debate about that too. I'm glad you brought that up, because even at that time, my father at that time, he was working at a nightclub, and they called them. They say, "Hey, can you come in? We got guns. I want you to come to the nightclub. We're going to stay on the roof. We don't want them to burn it down." And my dad told them on the phone. I was right there. Because I was visiting my dad, he said that, "No, I'm not going to do that. I already did that in Vietnam. It's not worth doing that." So my dad told me later on that DJ got shot there and stuff. On the roof. But yeah, a lot of people saw the news, and like some people would think at that time, like saying, "Okay, all Koreans are like that." Or some people see the news, all black people are like that. But no, it wasn't like that at all. Not all black people were pissed off at Koreans. Of course, there was people like that, but everybody was different. It really depends who you talk to, and who you really talk to. At that time, I was a college student too. Of course, there was tensions and stuff, but it really depends who you talk to. But, you know, if you see watch the news, you're going to think, "Oh, okay, I guess everybody was like that." But no, it wasn't like that. Not everybody hated each other and stuff.
I mean, do you have any other thoughts on the the LA Rebellion. You know, obviously, very interesting.
Yes, I would call it LA Rebellion slash also Riot, because there was
sure.
I saw people there, young kids who were just came there just to fuck shit up. They had no fucking thing. I mean, there was people like that all the time at different rallies. They would just come to cause problem, or sometimes, I don't know, maybe because it's once in a lifetime thing, so they would get happy, break anything, break any windows. I would think, why are they doing that? I would trip out. Even there were punks who were doing that too. Even the punks who were doing that, punk rockers who would come and do that kind of stuff. And I don't know. It's, I mean, the rebellion, the way I saw it, because we were there from the start, we saw everything, my friends and I. It brought people together, but at the same time, I have the mixed feelings. It brought people together. Then it brought me sadness, and certain gangs were beating. I don't know. A lot of people don't know this too, but if you talk to the street gangs at that time, they would tell you this straight out. Certain gangs will, certain black gangs will beat up Latino gangs. I don't know. There was a huge attention. Depends, because LA is so huge. Depends where you go. At that time, depends which neighbor you go. There's people getting beat up because of their different race, but certain communities in the daytime, they got together, they cleaned things up. Certain different communities were against all the violence, against breaking. And then there was individual organization, individuals. Certain people believed in breaking stuff on big corporation. Certain people were just say, wow, this is a fucking party. Let's break everything. Fuck shit up. It was just different because LA was so huge. There was all kinds of people there. But like I said, I have mixed feelings. It's hard. Depends where you are at and what neighborhood you are at.
For sure. Do you feel like the rebellion at all impacted the anarchist scene? Like, did people look at things differently? Did that impact people's organizing? I know, like, things came out of that. Like, for instance, the South Central Farm, was granted to farmers after the rebellion, which in the 2000s, people fought around the eviction of. It was ultimately evicted, I think, in 2006. But I mean, did it change people's perception at all, or change what they were doing?
Oh yes, a lot of positive things came out after rebellion. There was a lot of debate too. Like, people were saying that if there was never a rebellion, then they wouldn't get the officers wouldn't get tried again. Also, because of the rebellion, that's why Kwe Kudoran restarted the Black Panther Party, the New Panther Vanguard movement. Then all the Panthers. All the older generation of Panthers they were already organizing, but they started organizing, and Kwaku got the New Panther Vanguard movement going, recruited all these kids and stuff. Yeah, it did different things in different community.
So tell us a little bit about the space that you said it closed in 1994. How did that go? What kind of happened out of that?
Okay, so the Anarchist Center, D Center. When we first opened, it was really slow, very slow. It picked up fast. It picked up so fast. The front was all like zines, records, shirts, and the middle room had all kinds of books, library, workshop, refrigerator, kitchen in the back, and the huge backyard. They started having shows too. You would feel like about, I don't know how they did it. They'll fit in like 100 or 200 people. And then the show got so bigger, they had to do it in the backyard. At that time, even Channel 11 came and did an interview. And actually, like a couple blocks away, Zach from Rage Against the Machine had like what was his center called? They had a center too. I think it was called Peace Justice. I forgot what it was, but Zach from Rage Against Machine had a center. We went there. We told him we opened up an anarchist center, and it started picking up really fast when a lot of punks were volunteering. So after a year and a half, there was, of course, not just punk show. There was also workshop. Different groups came. A lot of different organizations came. There was also all women's space. There was potlucks. And then there was non-punk rock organization who would come by there, do their own thing. now we wanted to reach out more to the community, the locals, because all the locals kids started hanging out. So this is what happened at the end, towards the end, why the center closed. Local kids wanted to put out an event there. We said, yeah, sure. I mean, I wasn't there, but it was an open collective. So at that time, rave was very popular. Rave was going on. Rave is like techno music. So the local kids wanted to put out raves, and they keep on putting out raves there outside, DJing till 4 a.m. And I didn't even know that until way later on. So the neighbors got so pissed off. I want you to imagine hearing this techno bass going boom, boom, boom from like 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. constantly. So the neighbor did a petition to get us out. So
it was the damn kids that did it.
Yeah, the local kids who were taggers and everything, because we let them hang out, we let them put up the tent. So
it's just such the opposite of what, you know, every community organizer, you know, envisions. Like, oh, we're gonna get the community and the children will come, and it's like kids and their rave music
was really big back then. The rave scene was really big. So
for sure, yeah.
So the owner actually helped us move, and he fucking paid us money because he wanted us out so badly. The building owner paid us money. He fucking was there to help us move.
Was there ever like a crossover at all between like punks and rave?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, there were taggers. A lot of the punks.
Uh-huh.
A lot of the punks, LA, I'm talking about the LA punks. They grew up in a tough fucking neighbor. So they were already either in gangs before they were in punks or tagging crew. I'm not saying, oh, these are some of my friends. So they came from a like tough neighbor, like, Highland Park and East LA and everything. So, I mean, they were, besides punk, they were into everything. So
the next thing I wanted to ask you is that, you know, we'll talk about Resist and Exist, the band that you're probably most well known for being in. But, you know, through that work and continuing on, you developed a lot of connections with people that had been in the Black Panther Party and also kind of like new, Black Liberation formations. And I'm just curious, you know, when did that start? When did you start making those connections with people?
Before I met them, I did a zine. I did a fans. Okay. I watched a movie. I watched a movie called Panthers. I was watching a movie called The Panthers. I guess Bobby Sue was mad about that. So he was going to sue them or something. I don't know what the thing, but it really inspired me because I remember Tammy for Media Children in the late 80s. She was showing some kind of document. We were watching a document about Fred Hampton. I don't know what it was, all the raids. I didn't know too much about Panthers. So I watched the movie. The movie actually inspired me, and I was like, wow, this is so cool. I would like to meet some of these really radical militant group and stuff. So I did like 2 pages in my newsprint fanzine dedicated to the Panthers after I read all these books. I can't even name all these books, but I read about 15 to 20 different Panthers book by all different authors. So I put all these cool code and I Xeroxed some of the pictures. And I believe it was the very first October 22nd rally against police brutality. It was, I believe, 1995 in downtown LA. That's when I ran into the New Panther Vanguard, and I was going, wow, this is crazy. And I opened it up. The first woman I talked to was Boo Boo, and I told her, I dedicated a zine to you guys. It was for the Panthers and stuff. And she took a copy and I gave it to other Panthers and stuff. And they called me, they got my phone number Sharif called me, and Sharif Abdullah was saying, hey, come down to our headquarters, come and check it out. Panthers were cool. I looked up to them because all the radical community organizing they did and that stuff I read about. But I was not for sure. I didn't know for sure about the whole gun stuff back then. But I found out that they were not into that. They were more into community organizing. And so Sharif was telling me about it. At first, I was going, I don't know about it, you know, about going to the headquarters. But then I went, and that's how it happened. They had all. Everyone will have meetings and stuff.
And just to be clear, this is a group called the New Panther Vanguard Movement.
Yes, yes, New Panther Vanguard Movement. And they had a couple of the original Panthers in there, too. There was also Boko. Boko was in there. He was one of the Panther from he was one of the original People's Party 2. Oh gosh, I forgot where. This is so long time ago. But Vocal was in it also. That's how they were having like study groups every Wednesday, open discussion after the study group, and I told them, hey, I want to put on an event here. Can I put on an event here? And you go, yeah, sure. So then we started putting out events there. Few blocks away from there was community support at the Gang Truth Office / Coalition Against Police Abuse Office, which was run by Michael Zinzin. And we went there, hang out, we talked to Michael and everything. And we told Michael too, hey, there's not that many space. Can we put an event here? He goes, yeah, we'll do an open house for you before that. And that's how we started networking with all of them and stuff.
Because there's a... The band that you're in, Resistance Exists, put out a 7-inch called Dare to Struggle, Dare to Win. And there's a photo of you and somebody from the New Panther Vanguard movement.
Oh, that's
yeah. You have like really spiky hair and they have like a black leather jacket.
Was taken in 1996.
You know, one of the other things I wanted to bring up is you mentioned, the gang truce and after the. Right before the LA Rebellion, famously, there was a gang truce that was called and that kind of held. For several years and actually had a huge impact in a decline of inner city violence and murder. And the police, if you read the book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip Hop Generation, there's an excellent, chapter in there about the LA Rebellion, but it specifically talks about what the police and the government did to basically just try and destroy the gang truce. They would like break up barbecues between rival gangs that were coming together. They, you know, would attack people. Sometimes there were even like mini riots against that. But by and large, they were more or less unsuccessful and it kind of held for a long time. But I know that you made relationships with people that were within that world that were trying, that were basically came out of gangs that were trying to keep the gang truce alive or involved in peace treaty stuff. I believe one of them famously was Bloodhound.
Yes.
I'm just kind of curious if you can talk about good that.
Friends. I just talked to him on, I talked to him on the Facebook about 2 or 3 days ago. We talk once a week. Till this day, we are really, really good friends. We joke around and everything. Bloodhound. Yes. That kind of stuff. You got to interview Bloodhound. He will go on and on about gang truce. He could talk to you for 1 week nonstop.
Yeah, we'll have to do that. I'd love to have him on. But it just, I don't know, if anything you want to say on that topic or just that kind of aspect to it.
I would hang out. They would tell me about it. And I just saw stuff. What I saw, I mean, see, Bloodhound, Taco, they were in a different group. But, like, I would go to Taco. At that time, Taco was in Watts. Watts had a small office there when he broke off from the New Panther Vanguard movement. And he was saying something like the gang truce Watts is still holding. It was somewhere in the project, but I forgot what it was. It's so long time ago. Then, where Bloodhound was in was a whole different area. It was on Western Avenue. It was run by Michael Zinzin from Kappa. He was an original Panther to LA. That was really educational place too. That had computer classes for gangs. I saw that Bloodhound was doing workshop there. And they give gangs jobs because the back of the, in the back, they had a dome. The dome, they have silk screen. Gangs who can't get job, they would like silk screen shirts and stuff like that. But then it was not all just black gang. They had, cholo too. Cholo and stuff. They would come and like, you know, do stuff. So it was for everybody. So, yeah, you gotta talk to Bloodhound about that, man. Cause only the thing I saw was, you know, but they know all the history. They were totally involved with all the stuff. Cause when I talked to Bloodhound, I would like, you know, hang out with that. I would hang out in that area where the gang truth is, or I would not go to his, I mean, I went to his neighbor, but then there's his friends and everything. That's a friend you don't want to bring them to other area or they'll get like other political organization. It's a long, complicated story, but Bloodhound was really respectful. I mean, even there were so many rules, I would say, hey, Bloodhound, okay, go to the feminist group, but please do not say this word. Please don't talk about that. Don't talk about this. I have to give him a whole thing. But he was very fucking respectful. He would laugh. He'd go, yeah. Okay. Then I go, Bloodhound, okay, I know you're coming to the fucking anarchist book fair, folks, but please do not say this. Don't say that. I will give him a full rundown. I know there was always rule, but he never fucking complained. He was really cool about it and stuff.
So we're talking now kind of like mid to later 90s at this point. You know, you're in a band, Resistant Exist. You're starting to put out 7 inches and albums. I mean, anything else you want to say? We're kind of leading up to the start of the 2000s, where we're going to talk about the DNC. But I'm just kind of curious, between that point in the mid to late 90s and when the DNC hit, which was kind of like this high point of anarchism, which, of course, anarcho-punk played a huge part in Southern California. I'm just curious, anything else you want to say? Because also in this time, you know, as we've talked about, you know, we've talked to John Zerzan on here. We've talked to different people. Like, there was a lot going on. There was obviously, yeah, there was a lot of stuff going up from, like, people blocking logging in, you know, Oregon, to everything Anti-Racist Action was doing.
Yeah, yeah. The late 90s, also the, I mean, even in the 90s, the whole Riot Girl was going on.
Right.
We would do events with Riot Girls and the Panthers at the same time. We would all do it together. We did so many events like that, but they weren't big. They were like more small events and stuff. But now you said DNC. Yeah. So DNC was coming at that time. Now every 3 or 4 years, you have different group coming in. People get burned out, different group coming in. So before the DNC came on, my friend Camille, she was telling me, hey, DNC's coming. You guys have to do something. And Camille got out of it, but she was telling us that start a collective and put out a anarchist gathering.
You know, one thing I do want to ask you, in the band's, you know, kind of legacy, I remember in the Dare to Struggle, Dare to Win 7-inch, there was an essay that was put in there in the liner notes. It was called Abolish the White Punk. And I remember...
Yeah, Joel. It was written by Joel.
I'm just curious if you can kind of talk about that, because I remember at the time it was really groundbreaking in the sense, because it talked about race in a way that really hadn't been done before, it seemed like, or at least to me. I mean, as somebody that was like a young punk kid, like looking back on it, I'm just curious if you can talk about why you put it in there and kind of the impact of that essay.
It was my old roommate, Gino, because he's Korean. We used to live together a long time ago at a co-op house. And he would always talk about that. Oh, okay, people of color punk rock. You know, people of color punk rock would talk about that. Substantia was around back then. They talked about it. So then we saw this article by Joel. He was writing for Profane Existence. I never met him, but Nick from Spiral Records called me. Hey, you got to check out this article. Can I put it in the insert? I read it. I go, wow, yeah, go for it. And he goes, oh, he's white. I go, wow, that's more incredible. That's so awesome. He wrote about it. But that was so long time ago. I think, if I remember correctly, I think that article was to challenge the white punk rockers or something. I forgot what it was, but I don't even have that 7-inch, but yeah, so I thought it was really, really cool. So I told Nick, yeah, go ahead and put it on. Nick from Spiral Records.
And like, to be clear, it wasn't saying like, obviously, you know, get rid of white people. It was saying like, let's just think about kind of like these monoliths that we've kind of created in terms of culture and the way that we see the world, and like really deconstruct them.
It was like to challenge and stuff. It was written by a white person named Joel, but we thought it was really,
yeah,
cool. Cause in the movement, I was talking while the drum beat was going on, and I was saying something about people of color, but this is so long time ago. I don't even remember the lyrics because, yeah, it was a big poem about it. So, that's why it went pretty cool and stuff.
You know, the other thing I wanted to ask before we get to the DNC is that in the late 90s, there was a really cool record label called Tribal War Records. This is where like Osrotten and Antiproduct and Resistance Exist. It's kind of like, I mean, I hate to say it like this, but in my opinion, kind of like the best of the best of the bands in terms of not only the music, which, you know, it was kind of like crusty, hardcore, like post-peace punk type stuff, really political, bands identified largely as anarchists, but I'm just curious if you can talk about that record label, its importance, and also Profane Existence, which we haven't talked about, mm-hmm, and they really, again, deserve their own podcast. We've actually reached out to them several times about coming on, but they were an anarcho-punk magazine, like really well-designed, very thick. They had band interviews, but also news and stuff. So I'm just curious if you can talk about the importance of those two kind of pieces of infrastructure in the scene.
Oh yeah, so we met Neil. I used to write to him. We met Neil when we were on tour with Os Rotten and stuff. This is when we only had the 7-inch out. We were on a West Coast tour, and even Os Rotten, they don't fuck around either. Cause even in, those guys are all like 6 feet tall. And, in Bakersfield, these, it was only two. There was at a punk show, these two rockabillies, like, you know, they're tough guy. They were picking fights and took your shirt off. And then one of the guys had a Skinhead tattoo. So they used to be ex-Skinhead, I guess. So they were picking fights, and outside, they were punching someone. Os Rotten pulls out a belt and punched them, knocks the guy out. One other guy from Os Rotten maced them. Yeah, they don't fuck around too. Even in Portland, a Skinhead was causing a trouble. I think it was Corey. He jumps off the stage and grabs them and throws them out. Yeah, they were really, funny people and really nice people to hang out with. Os Rotten. And so anyways, we were on the tour together with Os Rotten, and we told Neil was a driver. I said, hey, I want to be on your label. So that's how we did it, to be on the four.
And shout out to Os Rotten, because they were one of those bands that, like, I mean, you would read their lyrics, like especially their later stuff, and it was like they had taken a Noam Chomsky book and like put it on to like a 2.5-minute song. Like you would walk away from, listening to a song about, I don't know, IMF structural adjustment programs, or like systematic racism and border violence, and like be able to like learn something and like have talking points about why something was bad. I don't know. I just remember they had some really powerful songs and like really in-depth lyrics.
Strict immigration will solve these countries' problems. The refugees are only our leaders' scapegoat! Big boss in the flames, not flames, score! God, I never given any boss or score! This lady, immigrants, and seven! Just our boss is an actual reception! Why boss, same opportunities they've been given! Death, refugees!
Os Rotten, one of the album, it came with a free Mumi Abu Jamal flexi, and they put a contact on the poster folder. They put a contact with all these organizations you could write to. Then also, like, Anti-Product came, and we played a couple shows with them, and they were on Tribal War Records as well.
Yeah, Axiom, which was like a anti-civilization green anarchist band out of Eugene, was really great.
Oh yes, we play with them.
But anyway, Tribal War Records, great stuff. If you can find any of the CDs, or I'm sure most of that stuff's on YouTube, check it out. Well, I'm curious if you could just talk about Profane Existence too a little bit.
Oh yeah, Profane.
Any thoughts or
the backbone of the anarcho punk scene at that time? Because of them, we were networking with, oh my gosh, all kinds of people. They were the total backbone. Yes, they did a lot of good things for the punk scene as well. We even did a benefit show for Profane Existence, organized one in San Diego, one in LA. And one in LA, a lot of the benefit show, you have to understand, Resistance Exists didn't play. Like all the shows I put out, I would always like, you know, when we organize shows, I would like get different bands all the time. So yeah, they even came to one of the Solidarity Festival in the late 90s as well. That's how I met Profane. Then when we went to Minneapolis, we met Dan. But at that time, gosh, I don't know what year. At the time, Profane Existence was no more. But I believe they're still online, though, going on online.
Let's talk about the DNC and just how that happened. I mean, so at this time, we're talking about 2000. This is kind of like in the period where Seattle had happened in 1999, so there was just like kind of a groundswell of things happening, and there was, like we said, there was everything from tree sits popping off that were blocking massive logging operations to anti-racist action was happening across the country, like thousands of chapters, yeah. Or hundreds of chapters, I should say.
A lot of my Long Beach friends were traveling too, so they were always in Eugene. So when DNC was going on, we had the anarchist conference and stuff. A lot of people don't know this. The reason the Black Bloc was short, there was about 30 to 40 persons block got arrested on the first day of DNC because they were going in a route, a total different route. Someone from the animal rights movement. He at that time he was into green anarchists too, but later on he became a snitch. He had an ALF tattoo in the back and everything, but
funny how that works out.
Yeah. He took all the fucking Black Bloc, 30 to 40 persons of the Black Bloc before on the first day of DNC got all arrested. When they got arrested, that's why the Black Bloc could have been bigger, but due to 30 persons of the Bloc got arrested, they held them until the DNC was over. Mm-hmm. But I got really pissed off about that. But the good thing that came out after that was they all got a settlement. They got money for it because they were wrongfully arrested. Because he took the block out to a whole different animal and some animal rights. He was doing some kind of anti-vivisection stuff on DNC. So without telling us, he just fucking took all the blocks. So we were short on block. But a lot of people don't know. Block could be really fucking huge, but 30 persons of the block got arrested on the first day of the DNC when it just went out. And they held them there until the DNC was over.
So what was the...
I mean, held them in the jail.
Yeah, what would you say the impact of the DNC was? Because, I mean, there was just, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people out there. I mean, there's there was a media collective called Cascadia Media Collective that did a couple of films. And they did one like DNC Alive in the Streets. It might be on YouTube somewhere. You can track it down somehow. But, I mean, it was a really good kind of like screenshot of just, you know, massive, massive black blocks.
It would have been way bigger. That block could have been way bigger. But anyways, yes. There was a network and everything.
That should be an anarchist t-shirt. The block could have been bigger.
Yes, because 30% were in jail. But anyways, it depends who you ask in the DNC, because there was also infight was going on with like members of Dan. I mean, some of the members of Dan were cool and stuff, but other people had problems. I didn't have problem with any of the organization because my focus was, you know, just my own business. I was doing my own thing. There was people who wanted to do different things. And there was sometimes, of course, there was disagreement, infights, and it's the weirdest thing. Like some car came and grabbed some kid who did a block and they put him in the car and they drove away to arrest him. And like undercover cop who was not in, on police uniform, they would just come get in a van. They would just, if somebody do something, they would just grab somebody and this fucking disappear. Was like a lot of weird shit was going on, man. So I knew like in the block, I was thinking, fuck, there's a lot of undercover. I don't trust fucking anyone. So I try to stay a distance after that, like the second day or the third day and stuff. Cause there's so many, I mean, there was all kinds of people. There's people who was there because It came from the heart, you know. So people were there, well, they want to see change, they want to organize, they want to network with groups. But like I said earlier, there's, I'm not going to mention names, there were just people there, they want to have a good time and just fuck shit up and just break stuff and all that. You know, you get all kinds of people at different rallies. You have to understand, all right, us human beings are all different. We're not the same. So you got crazy people, you got people who are really amazing and awesome. Wow, it depends who you ask in the DNC. People have different experience, but my experience, I thought it was very powerful.
It was interesting too because, you know, out of that, it felt like at the time, like the Southern California area really exploded, and this was kind of this magical time between, you know, the so-called Battle of Seattle in late 1999, and then, you know, up until the September 11th attacks were. Things kind of like people like, oh, but you know, there was a lot going on in LA and Southern California, Long Beach. There was like the Reach Center, I believe, in Long Beach.
This info shop.
Yeah. This young organizer, Sherman Austin at the time had a really interesting website called Raise the Fist, which was sort of like, I mean, you could definitely say it was the It's Going Down of it. I mean, I would say It's Going Down is the Raise the Fist of today. But, you know, Raise the Fist was like the go-to site to like get news. And it had like an open posting board and it had like a network of groups that were doing stuff. Yeah, there was a lot going on.
Oh, I'm just,
I know you, people in LA also opened up new centers and spaces at the time too, after the DNC.
Yeah, different organization was doing all different things. LA is so huge. It's like so hard to catch up with everybody. Like different people was different doing. See, like me after the DNC, I wanted to restart at AGC, Alternative Gathering Collective. So, that's how my friends and I, we restarted that because I was just really disappointed with the whole, like, because every time when punk starts, I mean, this is from the history. I'm not going to go into details from, every time when punk started collective, when we opened it up, other people would come in and try to push out punk rock or do something crazy. And I was so disappointed with the DNC. I was going, fuck, we wanted to make this so diverse and everything at the Anarchist Gathering. Now we can't. It just pisses me off. And that, so then the AGC started. That's how the Alternative Gathering Collective started. And the August Collective pretty much broke up too.
You know, it's interesting now because nowadays in the anarchist movement, if you go to like a big event, like there are still people that either have come out of punk rock or like, or, you know, just based on the way they look, or I don't know, they have a band t-shirt on. Like they're obviously into the music, but I mean, when I first got into anarchism, it was like, it was bizarre if you had not come through or you were involved with the punk scene. Whereas now it's kind of like you're the odd person out.
But it's really cool now because you have the internet. So like a lot of like activists will get into it. Like a lot of non-punk rockers will get into it. Me and my friends were talking about this when I was in Los Angeles, how different it is now in the anarchist scene. Way
sure. I just think it's interesting because without that punk rock element, I feel like, a lot of, like, what you lose, I think, is you lose a lot of, like, especially kids from poor and working class backgrounds because they're attracted to that kind of like rebellious subculture. But then also a lot of people where it's like, that's the only way that they hear about these ideas because they can't, you know, they don't live in a town where there's like an info shop or something. I mean, obviously, like you said, now is the internet, everybody with a phone can listen to this podcast or read something online. But I mean, you know, definitely, you know, being involved in punk will expose you to those ideas. And also I think too, just like the thing about the DIY punk culture was like, you know, if you were in a band, if you did a fanzine, if you did shows, like you had to like physically organize that stuff and like do it. And that gave you skills that meant like if you want people to show up to something or if you want this to be a success or if you want to put out this 7-inch or this project, I mean, you actually have to have people skills and be able to accomplish something. You can't just like be a smart ass on the internet, you know?
Also, you have to understand back then it was more easier to live in a co-op house. And easier to, open up info shops or centers, because the rent was, the pricing was so different back then. So yeah. When now there's gentrification, it's like now the generation, now it's going to be way harder for them to open stuff up like that, or get like a co-op house, and you got to put down payment and all that crazy stuff, and the rents go sky high and everything. And then, like I said earlier, that's why I have a lot of respect for LA punks, because they come from like the fucking craziest neighborhood and stuff.
Right.
Like really have a hard, tough life. And I don't want to go into details, but you know, like the brother, there's, you know, whatever, you know, like it's just, I have so much respect for punks in Los Angeles.
Well, you know, the other thing, just to kind of go back to our timeline here, you know, we were talking about just this explosion of stuff that happened. There was new spaces that opened up. There was, you know, websites. There was a lot of new groups in Southern California. I think the other thing that happened was that there was a wave of repression. Sherman Austin got slapped. He was the first anarchist, first person to be prosecuted under the Patriot Act. Because of his website, somebody actually put the story goes is that, a link to a website that had a link on that website to another website that supposedly had information on how to make pipe bombs or something was posted by someone else on Raise the Fist, not Sherman. But because of that, Sherman was like, prosecuted for like distributing terrorist information or something like that. Which is just ridiculous.
Things got scary too. Sherman was in jail. Ruckus was in jail. Fran Hobby was in jail, and he got deported. And then, of course, all the Long Beach people were in jail too. Like 100 Black Bloc people got arrested there. This is completely different rally, not DNC. 100 Black Bloc got arrested.
Mayday 2001, correct?
Yeah, that. And then some of the his craziest thing. This is just county jail, right? My later on, like some of the people I know who got out. I don't know why they tell me this, but you know, I'm cool because you know, jail's a different place. You got to do whatever you do to survive. But one of somebody I know is saying, "Hey, Jay, you're not going to believe this, man. I had to eat meat and jug. What happened? Because there was all this race separation, and they told me I had to sit with certain inmates in this crowd, and they told me, you know, I got to eat meat because if I don't, because I'm a Mexican, because I'll be a pussy. So they were going to jump me, so I had no choice to eat meat. And I told them, you know what? It's okay. Don't worry about it. You know, you got to do what you got to do to survive.
It's right. Yeah.
My other friend, he got punched in the stomach. This is just county jail, just for talking to somebody from different race. And I don't know, it was just this. What happened was shook some of the people from Long Beach as well. And some of the people from Long Beach dropped out. I have a lot of respect for like people like Rampage who didn't drop out and stuff. He was that I'm not gonna get into it, but he was in different thing. He was in jail for like three years. I'm in prison, not jail. He was in prison for 3 years. So it scared a lot of people. A lot of people got out of it because people were going to jail and stuff. I'm not gonna go into details, but you know. It's a whole different world there. People don't think about how it is. It's a totally different world. It's like.
Well, so there was a lot of police repression and surveillance and harassment.
Yes, there's a police repression, surveillance, harassment. But then in jail, then it's a whole different story. You're not.
For sure, yeah.
You're dealing with like serious, serious prison gang and stuff. And that's a whole different story and all that. But also,
for sure.
I have a lot of respect for Anarchist Black Cross. Matt and Lane from Anarchist Black Cross. That's the longest anarchist collective that exists in Southern California. And I have a lot, he did a lot of support. He even came to all the court solidarity. Every time the courtroom was packed, there was, Matt was there, ABC always supported the people, the folks and stuff. So then, because of all this repression, all the green anarchists, the people who claimed they were green anarchists and stuff, they got scared. They got out of the whole movement and stuff. But, me and my friends, even we didn't agree with some of the things our friends did. We didn't agree with it, but we supported them. We did benefit. We did court solidarity because, you know, they're friends. You know, your friends, you know, you help them out, you know. So we did everything to help them out and everything as well. Benefit shows, courts showing up to court, fundraiser, or sending books, or AGC, we had to raise money. I had to go all the way down, drive all the way down to Mexico to TJ to give Hobby money. And then we also helped out with the parents' rent because Rucka's mom, we helped them out. Oh, God, I could go on and on. But AGC, yeah. The collective, I don't know how. We're talking about thousands and thousands of dollars. We from beneficiaries, all kind, we would raise money so fucking fast. I don't know how we did it. The conflict came back and they donated a bunch of merch to us and we sold it. And we would use that money to help our friends out. So all this, when the whole green scare and the repression was going on, that really crushed us. AGC was gone. A lot of people got scared. Didn't want to deal with anarchist thing anymore. Then the whole green anarchy thing was gone and everything in Long Beach.
Wow. Looking back on that period, do you have any advice for like dealing with that? I mean, do you feel like people maybe could have handled it in a better way? Or, I mean, obviously there are some people that handled it in a less than honorable way in the fact that they snitched or became informants, but.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There was a lot of snitching stuff and scary things. When I went to court about the whole Black Bloc, there was a woman who showed up. She was in the block and she showed up as a police officer and stuff too. God, and all that. Yeah. So
I'm just curious. So now we're kind of like in the early 2000s. And I think that's kind of like where we're going to leave off on the timeline. But I mean, in terms of the musical stuff with your band, I mean, you know, you've toured with like Against Me, who's gone on to be pretty big and stuff. I mean, looking back musically, are there any highlights or, you know, you have any interesting stories just in terms of just, being in a band?
I remember
or touring or
we did a 1 month tour and Neil from Tribal War was driving us. In that 1 month, we had only 2 days off. We played all the states in America except for Florida and Alaska and Hawaii. But anyway, we're playing all over. What really touched my heart was everywhere we go. I mean, there, some of them are gone. They had small info shop or like a collective or co-op house. Really touched my heart to see that. And even the smallest area, there was small collective going on. There was all these small things going on in different state and different cities and stuff. So that was really inspiring and stuff.
Yeah, totally.
But then you got to understand, like, I'm not that smart, but a lot of people were like really fucking educated. So being in an anarcho band to me was really fucking hard at that time too. Because like people will ask me challenging questions. They will go, oh, where did this and that? I'm sorry. And I have to be honest with them. I'm sorry. I'm not that well educated about that. I don't want to, you know, make decisions that things I don't know too much about. They would ask me always fucking hard questions and stuff. It was kind of hard. Being in an anarcho band was hard. Like people would fucking come and challenge me at shows and stuff. Hey, why is this like, you know, not benefit for that? And I was going, fuck. You know, it was really hard. You mean anarcho punk band was really, really hard and stuff.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't want to go into detail, but it was just hard. What I'm trying to say is people look at you like a telescope. Mm-hmm. And then they challenge you. Like, you know, when you're in a band, like, when you're in a band, like, normal people would think, oh, you know, people respect you and that. No, it wasn't like that as for fucking anarchists. The anarchists, even with the punk, anarchists, different anarchist punks will come and fucking try to debate me, and they get mad if it's not a benefit, or, oh man, it was so crazy.
Yeah, there was very much of, you know, I think there's even like a Econochrist song, like, you know, how much do you resist? How much by what percent? Something like that, one of the lyrics. But yeah, there was a lot of that, you know, where like, why are you drinking a Pepsi? You know, why?
Not like that too. But even if people are getting an argument or something crazy happened, if I don't pick sides, then, you know, I get slandered, or somebody, ex-member makes stories about me, or I said this or that. I go, what the fuck? This is just crazy. But you know what? I never retaliated. I just let it go. You know, I didn't choose sides or anything like that.
Couple of last questions. What was your favorite tour that you did? And what were the bands that you toured with?
I'm going to tell you this crazy. We played over 400 shows. Jen, that's what Jen told me. She collect all the flyers. I never collect all the flyers, over 400. It's so hard to remember everything. It's so hard. But I'm going to tell you this. The place I had most, it really touched my heart, was playing in Mexico. The reason was the punks, the way they talk to me and treat me, it was really amazing. It really touched my heart.
Can you talk a little bit about that? That's actually one thing we haven't talked about, is that you all really, because just your position in LA, you know, you connected with a lot of the anarchist punk bands down there, and just that relationship.
Okay, before I say that, I just want you to know, now the shows are not like how it used to be. Like, you know, remember I said all challenging and stuff like that? But that's how it was, like, you know, after the DNC and everything. But now it's different. But anyways, in Mexico, it really touched my heart, because like certain areas was very, very fucking poor. And then and these punks, like, they were all kinds of punk. You have like different punk scene. They even like vegan collective, anarchist collective, anarcho-syndicalist, also fucking green anarchists. I met fucking green anarchists in Mexico and stuff. They were really cool and nice. But the thing is, the reason I say this about Mexico was so awesome is because people are so respectful and everything. People were so nice. And I was going, wow, this is fucking amazing. And the scene is so huge. We've been to Mexico a few times. We've been to Toluca, Guadalajara, Mexico City with a band called Fallas Sistema. We checked out the different anarchist centers there. The cool thing about Mexico, everyone goes, not just punks, even the fucking non-punk anarchist activists go, death rockers go, people who are into metal go, everyone goes. So I thought that was really cool. Then even after the show, people would hang out and talk and everything. So everything was cool. I loved it. I like the culture there and the people there and stuff.
Yeah.
Really friendly. That's why we've been there a few times and stuff.
What's your favorite record that you put out?
I don't really have a favorite record. I know this is going to sound fucking crazy, okay? Like, when I hang out with my friends, they would say, hey, like, my friend Ralph will say that, hey, this is Jay from Resistance. I will pull him to the side. Ralph, don't fucking sound from Resistance. I don't know why. I would get embarrassed, but if somebody said, oh, this is Jay from, he's a lifeguard instructor, CPR instructor, I get really proud, like, really proud. I would go, oh, thank you. Like, I'll be so, I could talk, but when somebody says, oh, he's from Resistance, I get embarrassed and stuff like that.
Well, we've been talking for a long time. It's been great to nerd out and talk about all these histories. Anything else you want to touch on or talk about?
The only thing I want to mention is, due to I don't have a rough draft, I know I left so many things out, and people are listening. I'm sorry, this is not it's not educational. I'm not that smart, but the only thing I'm good at is like I'm more of an organizer, like doing fundraising stuff. So I wish I was more like smart, like my friends are, how I could say educational stuff, but. And I left a lot of things out and stuff. So that's all I'm going to say. So I'm just apologizing in advance if I left a lot of things out or if my talk is not that educational. That's all. But I just want to say, just live your life. Do your thing and stuff. Just do what's in your heart and stuff and stay true. Stay true and stuff and just follow your heart. And there's going to be a time if you don't agree with things, go with your heart, you know, go with your heart. Don't change or don't listen because all the majority of people say. That's what I did, and I made so many mistakes by doing that as well.
All right, thanks so much.
Yes, for sure. And one thing, never give up. Always stick with your beliefs, stand firm.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.